Bennifer is back. Brad and Jen are friends again. And Paris Hilton is somehow still making headlines. 20 years later, we're living in the world that the 2000s tabloids created. On this series, I'm going to tell you the story of a decade of American life through the trash we love to consume. From Spotify and the Ringer Podcast Network, I'm Claire Malone, and this is Just Like Us, the tabloids that changed America. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, forever trying to perfect the work-life balance, it's Andy Greenwald.
I love it. I I'd love to have that conversation with you in addition to talking about Severance, because which is the Apple TV Plus show we're going to be talking about this week. That's usually your job to do that, but I'm just doing it. I'm running.
I love it when you run point, man. I can just come off the ball and just like do little curls. Just take some shots up.
Do you think of me as a ball dominant player, ball dominant wing?
You're kind of like big. You're like Rip Hamilton. It's basically like you do a lot of like work off screens and running around. Uh-huh. And then once I give you the ball, it's a black hole and I'm not going to get it back.
I know what to do with it. Also, yeah. Surprisingly fragile facial bones, if
that's
I remember
right.
correctly.
That's right.
Very You've tender to the touch.
Potting in a mask for the last 3 months. Andy, what a day today. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the TV news that's come out of the TCAs, which is, for people who don't know, the Television Critics Association. They have this, I mean, not a convention, but an annual sort of gathering of the juggalos where everybody comes and shows their wares to the TV Critics Association. And often a lot of news comes out of that. There was also a Paramount Investors Day, which I somehow was not invited to.
Weird, Chris.
Yeah,
weird.
I mean, I'm basically a homesteader in the Taylor Sheridan universe, but did not get the invite there.
I also thought that it was part of the larger, as an Aaron Eckhart stockholder, I thought that was part of a larger, you know, like there's like a Bernstein account where like they're like, you have stock in a bunch of things and then it's all grouped together. I thought that Aaron Eckhart was offloaded. A lot of that stock went to Viacom. In a distressed asset
swap. Like it was like a mutual fund or something? Like,
exactly.
We don't really know what
exactly.
we're talking about doing.
No.
None. Anyway, we have a bunch of stuff to talk about today. And then also we're going to spend the second half of the show chatting a little bit about Severance, which is the new show from Ben Stiller on Apple TV, which is premiering. I don't know how Apple does it. It's either tomorrow morning or tonight. I think it's tomorrow morning.
I think the signs say 17th. So I think it might even be out.
The signs say that? Okay, so it's not, I didn't see it like as recording at 2:00, I did not see it. It usually says, I think it says on Apple TV available Friday. In any case, okay. By the time you listen to this, I think Severance will be available.
You know what, guys? Can we just pause recording? I'm going to go check out the billboard on Sunset and Alvarado, because I feel like that's where I get most of my news. So
Kai and I will just talk about Irish communism for a little while you're out.
Just stretch.
Andy, where do you want to start? I had this bit about Paramount at the top, but that is also my bias. Of that Paramount stuff, I really have nothing else to tell you other than the fact that Taylor Sheridan is making 5 more shows, apparently. And I have some notes on those, but we could do that, or we could start with John Landgraf, the head of FX's annual State of the Union.
Let's start Paramount. I mean, I think that there... I mean, at first, let's just start with Paramount. Like, this is insane. Are they trying to break a person? Like... At a certain point, no one is going to be mad at Taylor if he's like, this is my guy, Jim. Jim writes shows sometimes too. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, that's cool. There's no shame in that, right?
So they said
five more shows. You want to talk them through?
That Taylor was going to take a step back from his show running and directing responsibilities to concentrate on writing. And I had actually forgotten that he does that. You know, he does do show running and directing for a lot of these shows. Yes. So obviously now we have Yellowstone's on the air. Mayor of Kingstown concluded its, well, Yellowstone and Mayor of Kingstown recently concluded seasons. And then 1883 is wrapping up its first season. There was already a couple of these shows have been announced, but just to run through all of the ones that sort of kind of got solidified this week. Yellowstone, 1883, Mayor of Kingstown. Mayor of Kingstown is coming back for second season. There's Tulsa King, which is a Sylvester Stallone 1930s gangster show about a guy who goes away from a mafioso from New York who goes away to prison for 25 years. Maybe it's not in the 1930s. Comes out and is exiled to Tulsa, where he basically reconstitutes a mob out in Oklahoma. Then, not the same show, he is also doing a show called 1932, which is specifically part of the Yellowstone universe and is about the son of one of the people on 1883 during Prohibition in the 1930s. Then other shows he's doing include The Lioness, which is a Zoe Saldana CIA show, Bass Reeves, a David Oyelowo Western, and cool. Landman, which is the show that I'm most hyped up about, which is the Billy Bob Thornton oil business fixer show, which is based on the Boomtown podcast. And that's where I want to start our little conversation about these things. I saw something this week that was really quite moving to me, Andy. It's I feel like sometimes we're calloused over to joy in this world, you know, maybe it's we've spent too much time online and our nerve endings are shot or whatever.
For sure.
But what I saw was this. In a promotional video for Paramount, I saw that Billy Bob Thornton was talking about Landman, working with Taylor Sheridan. Billy Bob's also on 1883 briefly. And Billy Bob Thornton was wearing a knit hat. And then on top of the knit hat, Billy Bob Thornton was wearing a fedora. Now, we don't really put out a lot of video or anything from this podcast, and I don't expect us to. Are you... Yeah, so Kaya,
I'm
you
just
can
looking
see
at
this
it.
Now.
I want Andy's Kaya looking to at see it.
This isn't great podcasting, but that's what happens when a man has got it all. And I don't mean this metaphorically. You can really literally wear multiple hats. You've made one false move. You went to battle over the director's cut of All the Pretty Horses. Mm-hmm. You've been in Armageddon. You were deeply in love with Angelina Jolie, albeit briefly. And then you arrive at this place in your life where you're on Amazon all the time in Goliath. You're a respected musician, you know, and you're just a guy who can put two hats on, you know. And I want to know, how much more podcasting do you think I have to do to be able to do this, to literally wear a knit hat with a fedora or a cowboy hat on top of it?
Well, first of all, it's a great question. I think that, so thank you. I want to begin there from a place of gratitude. Two,
also, thank you to the universe for Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah. You, Chris, it's a complicated issue because you wear one hat a lot. Do you know what I mean? And yeah. I say this with love and affection. Like, the majority of your work life these days is talking into a microphone. You're a podcaster. You're the best at what you do. So it's really one hat. So I think that you could theoretically diversify your professional portfolio and earn a second hat.
Sure.
But at the moment, you're a one-hat guy. Now, what I want to know is, do you think Billy Bob has always worn multiple hats? Because Sling Blade, I believe he did more than one thing, right, from the beginning. Do you think it's in kind of like a low-key drive-by on Taylor Sheridan, being like, you may think you wear many hats, but I have owned hats longer?
I think you're confusing our listeners, though. I'm not talking about the roles he plays
sure.
or like what he does in his professional life. He literally, from a haberdashery standpoint, refuses to choose between knit hat and fedora, so puts both on at the same time.
You see,
while promoting a new television show.
See, I think this is weird, though, honestly. Look, let's keep it real. I think it's a little weird for you to pick on this because you, Chris, are a man who
I'm
every day wakes up.
I'm
wait,
celebrating.
Hold on. Wait, excuse me for a second. Okay. I know you had, Chris had some fancy matcha this week, and all of a sudden.
Ceremonial grade.
It's cooking in his veins. All of a sudden, he's got a different attitude. What I want to say, Chris, is that every day you wake up and you refuse to choose between shirts and jackets.
That's true.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, that's true.
I think there's something deeper here. Like you, as discussed on this podcast, you are known as a layer king. You are a guy who looks at your torso in the morning and expects greatness. This is, you look at your body as a load-bearing vessel for multiple items of clothing, often contradictory items of clothing. And I think what's fueling this conversation, I'm sorry, Kaya, cover your ears. I think it's a little bit of envy because I don't think you thought this kind of layering could migrate above the neck. And
that's,
I think
right,
that you're...
I'm like a character in 1883 who stopped at Abilene. I'm,
yes,
like, here I am. Yes. I thought I was in the West, you know? Right. And then I, yes, meet a true frontiersman.
Yes. Or you're a character in the Sheridanverse who stopped in 1883 and didn't even know about 1932.
I didn't
you're
even
like,
know.
What? What? 40 years from now? What?
Which of these shows for a layman is most appealing?
Mm. Well, at first I just want to say, I am in awe of this guy, of Taylor Sheridan, because it's not just of all the things he does and whether or not I like them or not. It's pretty incredible to just apparently have a limitless bucket of ideas that are exactly what his viewers and his fans want, that are so tailor-made to service the segment of the viewing population that Paramount has very smartly carved out for him to service.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, they all sound like good ideas. And they also, and I don't even know how to articulate this, none of them sound like reinventing the wheel ideas, which is what he's so good at. You know what I mean? Like the Bass Reeves story, for people who watched Watchmen, Bass Reeves is a character that, mm-hmm, signifies in Watchmen, the black cowboy, the famous American icon, not famous enough. Making a show about him and his life, that's a no-brainer. Great. Then you get David Oyelowo, you know, a great actor, Academy Award nominated actor, phenomenal. Boomtown Podcast, have not listened, but aware of it and like seems interesting. Again, that slots in. That's not it's not in the Yellowstone verse per se, but of course it just makes sense. And I think that we rarely see this kind of clarity of thinking in the auteur shingle camp.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, generally you can see this kind of thinking in a corporate division, or like when we praise Disney for streamlining what it does into franchises, sure. But often, like the elevated, highly paid auteurs, as soon as they get that nine-figure deal, they want to show all the different things they can do, you know? And Taylor Sheridan has been really smart about managing his career.
Yeah, I mean, the only person I can really think of that's comparable, aside from like the sort of corporation-level, mm-hmm, Dick Wolf stuff, is Berlanti, Greg Berlanti, who has, yeah, at any given time seemingly 10 or 12 shows on the air. But, you know, as I was reading a lot of the interviews that were coming out of TCAs this week, Casey Bloys from HBO was talking about the various things that J.J. Abrams is involved with aside from his overall with Warner. So like him, mm-hmm, making a Star Trek movie for Paramount and a show for Apple. And I was like, none of these shows are on. You know, Taylor Sheridan's actually got like 5 shows. I mean, he seems to have developed a working relationship with Paramount, where stuff goes from the page to the screen pretty quickly, which I'm sure is something that like encourages his own creativity. You know, if I had to guess, it's like the ease of use with the mechanism of getting stuff on the air of like, you know, and he shoots a lot of stuff, you know, on his ranch in Texas or on his ranch in Montana, and has kind of developed his own cottage industry. I just wonder whether or not like the dude is straight up just going to like burn Final Draft out. You know, they're going to have to come up with a new program for him.
He will reach the final draft.
Like, exactly.
He will be well named. No, him and Tyler Perry are industries unto themselves, and I don't think there's anyone else even remotely close. It's wild.
So one of the things that came out of this Paramount conversation, there's some stuff I would like to chat about. We can do maybe down the line about like Showtime eventually being, it's Showtime's online streamer being maybe subsumed under Paramount Plus, and how Viacom CBS is going to rebrand as Paramount. Like basically everything is kind of getting a cleaner branding, and also you're going to start to be able to find, which, you know, they've got to like, they still are kind of working out the fact that the most popular show that they've produced in the last 10 years is not available on the Paramount Plus streaming app, which is Yellowstone. But there was a bit of Yellowstone news that I thought was noteworthy, which is that the next season, the 5th season, will be quote unquote supersized but split in half, which now seems to be a not uncommon thing to be happening. Just this week, It was also announced that Stranger Things would be, the fourth season of Stranger Things would be split in half. We already knew the Better Call Saul's final season was going to come out in two parts. Ozark's final season is being distributed in two parts. The first one aired in the beginning of the year, and then the second half, I think, comes out in the summer at some point. But, you know, at a time when all this kind of, there's so much conversation over how stuff gets distributed, what the release schedule is going to be. I was curious if you had any thoughts on whether or not this was a product of COVID, mm-hmm. of shows maybe being delayed production-wise, or whether this was another curveball that the industry is throwing to see if it attracts a little bit more stickiness to its shows from viewers.
I think it's yes to all of it. I think it'd be foolish to discount the disruptive role COVID has played in everything. And so, yes, it's a factor. It could just, you know, in certain shows, in the case of certain shows, it could be that because of the COVID delays, the entire season won't be finished in post in time. And so they're making this decision to pivot because it's been a long time. I think because of COVID, but also just because of the nature of how TV is made and the sheer number of projects that popular creators find themselves involved in, there is no longer anything close to a guarantee that shows can come out on a 12-month schedule or an 18-month schedule or even a 24-month schedule. This week, we saw the announcement that Barry season 3 is finally coming to HBO and HBO Max, and there were some exciting photos of Bill Hader and Steven Rude and Anthony Carrigan, and it's been 3 calendar years since that show was on television.
Yeah.
That's wild. That's wild. I mean, there have been reboots, I think, of canceled shows that have pulled it together faster than that.
You're probably right.
I'm not saying that with any like snarkiness. I can't wait for Barry season 3. That show has 100% Q rating. People love it and will be excited for it. But that's the nature of the scheduling now. And so I think that the distribution model, and this was a big piece of John Landgraf's interview as well, for people who want to check it out on Deadline, that is very much that's a high point of conversation in the C-suites of all these companies. You know, what's our best method of not just getting this to the consumer in a way that it will spark, but managing the conversation, controlling the conversation, getting into the conversation. And then you add the next piece of it, which is that this is a subscription-based business. And for something like Netflix, right, which, as we've discussed, has enormous hits across the board in many fields. But in terms of like homegrown success stories that drive traffic, as to go back to the beginning of my rant, not just season to season, but every other year or so, Stranger Things is at the top of the list.
Yes.
So if you finally get this new season together, are you really going to dump it on a holiday weekend and then be like, is the floor still lava?
Right.
No, you're going to say, we're going to give you a whole bunch of it. And then you're not going to cancel your subscription because we're then going to give you more later. I mean, they're spreading the wealth around to try to keep the conversation going and to keep the bottom line where it is. It's all connected. Every conversation is, yes, about creativity and content, but very much about bottom line and finances as well.
Yeah, this seems also, the Stranger Things thing specifically. So there was the Duffer Brothers, who do the show, kind of put up a note to fans that was essentially like, this has been the most challenging, but also the most rewarding season. And we've poured so much into it and it's epic that we don't want not only to rush it, but it wound up being bigger than we thought it was going to be. And this mm-hmm. is a show that I think had an extensive writing period and then stop start production period as it moved around and had to deal with COVID stuff. So it's not that surprising that something like this is happening. But one thing that I think I noticed over seasons 2 and 3 of Stranger Things was the thing that happens with returning Netflix shows, where it's like you can get people hyped for its return, but the conversation that happens after it is a little bit more fluid. So I remember when the first season of Stranger Things aired and it was like, hey, have you checked this out? This is actually pretty good. Whoa, this is really good. Whoa, this is a huge sensation. And it was felt like a month, 5 weeks, 6 week conversation. The second and third seasons were a little bit more like hardcore fans watch it in a weekend. Normie people watch it over the course of a couple of weeks or whatever, but there was no real, like, how do we talk about this understanding? So now what they're going to do is put out part 1 of season 4 on May 27th. And then they're going to put out the second part about a month later on July 1st. So this is the penultimate season. They announced that the 5th season would be the final one. I think it's really smart. It's a way around, you know, Netflix's clearly unbending, mm-hmm. Binge model. is to give people less but more.
Yes. I'll say that also a part of this release strategy was to announce that, don't worry, it's half the season, but everything is twice as long.
Right.
Which, okay, it sounds a little bit like a threat to me, you know, because I would say as a fan who really loved the first season and bought in even to the, I mean, a lot of the show is intentionally derivative. I mean, and celebratory of a certain type of fandom and culture from our youth. Like, I bought in. I would say that my issue with the subsequent seasons was it's a little less charming when there's that much of it. You know, I just felt like it could have used some editing. But that's, you know, Netflix's model is more is better, unless it comes to seasons of Glow, in which case it disagrees. But can I, before we move on?
No, because I was going to ask you about Saul and the splitting the Saul seasons.
Oh, that's what I was going to come to also. First thing I want to say about Better Call Saul, so excited for the show to come back. They can give it to me however they want to give it to me. I'm really excited about it. I imagine a bunch of people listening have already found this, but last week the New York Times had a big profile of Bob Odenkirk written by, I believe, Jonah Weiner.
Yeah, Jonah
Weiner. And it was a great piece. And I just have to call out something about this piece that I've not stopped thinking about since I read it.
Was it like the various parts of Albuquerque that get mentioned that you were deeply familiar with from living in Albuquerque?
Yes and no. It was related to being in Albuquerque. It's that Bob Odenkirk, the star of Better Call Saul, the engine that fuels that show, since season one, has chosen to live in a share house with Rhea Seehorn and what's his name?
Patrick Fabian. Yeah.
I feel so warm and fuzzy and happy when I think about this, I cannot express it to you. Because as someone who lived alone in a rented house in Albuquerque with, you know, I was the busiest I've ever been in my life, but I was not the star of a franchise television show. I can't imagine the demands on Bob Odenkirk's life. The fact that he understood himself and his like emotional state and what he needed as a person to be like, I just want to hang out with my pals. Like, I want to come back from set and then like shoot the shit over like carrot sticks and hummus in the kitchen island for a few minutes. And then they let Rhea Seehorn have the master bedroom. I was so delighted by this. I just find him to be such a fascinating, clearly good-hearted and complicated figure. And it tracked in a way that I found really fulfilling with the version of him that, remember, he was on the podcast at the first season of Better Call Saul. And the only guest that I have ever interviewed who asked to step down midway through so he could have a little food because his blood sugar was crashing.
I have a follow-up question. Do you really think at this stage in your life that you could have a non-familial roommate situation?
I've thought about this a lot. I've been thinking about this.
Because I was like, I love you. I don't know if you and I would love living together. Because I feel like you like your private time sometimes.
We're only children. We are literally, when we talk about private time.
But you know me, I'm the dad.
Chris,
I come in, I want to get a little bit of Andy time. I want to see like, hey, like, look, the end of this Lakers game is on. Maybe you and I could play a little Halo. You know, maybe Chris, we could get into something a little bit racier than carrot sticks, you know?
When it comes time to discussing the need to be alone, we are Bane, okay? Like other people flirt with the dark. Only children were fucking born into it.
Okay? They don't know our struggle. They don't.
It's fine. Like, it's okay. And I think, much like the heroes of Gotham versus Tom Hardy's masked menace, one must fight that tendency towards solitary darkness.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, at the end of like 14, 15-hour days on set, I was not feeling my most like chipper and chatty. But I also feel like some normalizing human interaction, you know, would have been welcome, which is actually I did have, because as we've talked about on the pod, the great actor Brian Garrity had the adjoining house. And so I would try to sneak past his door where he'd have like classic rock playing from his like small Sonos speaker. And he'd be like, hey, and then you'd have to go in and talk to him for a while. So, but yes, I can't believe you think, I think we would be fine. Also, it's not a small house. You know
no,
what I mean?
Know. Like, it's not like they have one bathroom between Rhea Seehorn, Bob Odenkirk, and Patrick Fabian. I'm sure
my
it's
sense
a lovely,
is they
like
all
a,
have their own en suites.
Yes.
They can miss each other. I thought you were going to say I didn't want to stay with you, not because you were going to invite me to have like adult carrot sticks. By the way, we're circling back to that and playing Halo. It's that like the last time
grade carrot sticks.
Exactly. It's that the last time we shared a room, a hotel room, which is already now like 7-8 years ago, I learned that you do sleep like Nosferatu with earbuds in, like which I did not know about you. I did not know that when it was time to sleep.
We went to San Diego together?
Yeah, we went to Comic-Con together and we shared a hotel room for one night. And we were probably chatting, having a nice time. There were two twin beds or whatever it was. And when it was time to tuck in, you put in your earbuds, you said good night, and you crossed your arms over your chest like Bela fucking Lugosi and like laid back like you were going into cryo sleep. And then you didn't move again.
You have to recharge the batteries however you can. And I choose to put on basketball analytics pods and just zone out until I...
But how do you call your sleep position like Babe Ruth? You know what I mean? Like, I don't... I'm more freeform.
I have since become... God, this is really good content. I've since become a much more of a side sleeper and candidly, like just have found that, like, getting a pillow in between the knees really, like, is very comfortable. So, really? Yeah, like, I mean, apparently, like... You know, it just happened. I just realized that was like something that was bothering me, was like rubbing my knees together a lot during sleep.
Like,
so I've
like
changed is what I've said. I'd be curious to see how I was with you now.
It's true that the noise made by your knees did keep me awake. The staccato rhythm beating out against the San Diego night, just
slowly grinding away on my MCLs.
They were like, the cicadas are back, and I was like, no.
I don't really have like a take on Atlanta being, I think, is right. If I read this correctly, Atlanta 3 and 4 are both coming this year.
I was surprised by that. Yeah. Like, I thought that, so this is some other FX news. I mean, how many years has Atlanta been off the air now? Even longer. The event we did for season 2 was 2018, right?
So yeah, and that was the end of season 2. So yeah.
So it's been off the air for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
I assumed that when they were block shooting seasons 3 and 4, that they would at least stretch it for 2 years worth of content. They are not doing that. Landgraf said that season 3 is coming soon, in the next month or two, right?
Well, season 3 is premiering at South by Southwest next month, in a matter of weeks. Yeah, so yeah. I think the first episode or first two episodes are playing at South by Southwest, and then it'll be on shortly after that. Landgraf said a bunch of interesting things. Obviously, he has been... So every year he kind of does this sort of data-driven speech about the state of the industry. He talks about peak TV. He had predicted that peak TV was several years ago. I guess I had never actually really given much thought to the idea that there would be something after peak TV, and maybe there would be a little bit of a contraction, which obviously hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. He talked about how, like, clearly we are in some sort of peak TV, and we'll actually are probably not even there yet, as, you know, I'm sure Peacock, Comcast will be like spending billions of dollars to prop up that service. So like there will be more and more shows to watch, but he talked about like a state of bewilderment settling over the TV watching, Republic. And basically, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell, is he referring to more of like a upper percentile of very, very engaged television consumer, TV media member and industry member, or is he talking about like there is like a sense now that if you're just, I like watching 2 or 3 shows, I just can't find anything because there's just too much to choose from. Like, who is he really referring to? But I thought this idea of like of entering TV bewilderment zone is an interesting one.
Yeah, I thought that whole thing was interesting. I especially liked reading his comments in contrast with Casey Bloys from HBO. HBO and HBO Max are having a moment right now. It is not just that, you know, we obviously love HBO shows and talk about them constantly, and they've never not been a driver for our interest because of where we are as TV fans, but a consensus opinion has been forming based on actual data that, oh, wait, this might work, that HBO Max is a legitimate competitor in the streaming wars and that it has some legs. That's been a development. And Casey, to his great credit, continues to do these interviews where he is floating above the fray. I think it served him really well, and I think it's smart. But I did think it was interesting that this would be the moment when a more pugnacious old media titan would just take shots, right? Mm-hmm. And be like, we were right. Our commitment to this type of quality or whatever, this has been borne out by the facts and we're just getting started or whatever. And Casey just, you know, kindly and politely parries on almost everything. They're like, here are the 6 Game of Thrones spinoffs we know about. And he's just like, I'm not sure about that. I'll have to look into it.
Well, he knows. Like, we have one coming and we're working on others.
Exactly. Yeah. Here's the one that is coming on
television.
Which
is actually
so
what made the very end of that interview that you're referring to, which is, I believe, The Hollywood Reporter. The very last line, after basically poker facing the entire thing, he's just like, yeah, and True Detective is coming back.
Yeah, he did. They finally cracked him. Like 19 questions. He was like, I will be speaking about these 3 topics, and they only include the shows that are currently on our air.
Right.
And then, yeah, he did slip about
at
that.
At the end, they were like, what about True Detective? And he was like, watch this space.
I also think it was worth noting that he was communicating something that is, I think, true. I don't think this is a pose, which is that because of HBO, I think he's interesting because he's succeeding in the streaming marketplace, but he is the steward of the old HBO legacy that you and I value so much and talk about. And I do think that his comments about, like, why would we reboot 6 Feet Under? Why would we take another run at Girls? I think is accurate. I think that, you know, the marketplace is demanding new versions of everything, and I'm sure they're testing the waters on a bunch of stuff. But I do think that he is invested in that idea that sometimes it's okay to leave well enough alone, and I think he's secure enough in his position to allow that to happen. I think that the Landgraf situation is in some ways more interesting because over the previous decade, he carved out such a unique spot in the TV landscape. I mean, the critics called him the mayor of TV because he loved to do these press conferences, but he also loved to joust and parry with the media and curry favor with the media, frankly. Like, you know, of all the executives, he was the first and most consistent executive to just be like back channeling messages to me when I was a TV critic, not like meddling or like, you know, trying to work the refs, but just be like, that was an interesting point, which I thought was interesting that he was really clued into that stuff from an earlier time. He also had that ability because FX was such an underdog and was punching so far above its weight, making Emmy nominated shows, being in the conversation with the networks that were spending so much more money and, you know, proving that these legacy relationships with talent were worth having, right? Like that was the place where people went, whether it was Donald Glover or in a, you know, a pre-cancellation time, Louis C.K. You and I've talked about this before, but the marketplace and everything has put FX in a very different position and one that I'm very curious to see how it punches its way out of. Landgraf was saying there's too much TV, but to compete, he's had to amp up, you know,
he's make more.
FX studios, and he's going to make a lot more. A lot of those, you know, legacy, like overall creative deals, I don't know how much fruit they've borne because either they, you know, in the case of Louis C.K., that they ended the deal. Donald Glover made the shows for a while and then took like a much, much exponentially bigger deal from Amazon who could afford to pay it. And FX is existing in this odd place where they finally have a corporate parent that could, you know, make the money machines ring out. But that corporate parent is Disney. And how much they want to be in the prestige-y business that FX is in remains to be seen. So it's interesting. They have such a track record of making good bets, though. And then I don't know if you want to get into it, but like listing some of the new content that's coming, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, like, I mean, there's not a single FX show that I'm not interested in. Upcoming FX show. I mean, most of all, The Old Man with Jeff Bridges, but there's a bunch of really cool shit coming that they talked about.
And one thing to always keep an eye on for FX that we've shouted this out before, their half-hour development, you know, which just delivered Reservation Dogs to us when we did not expect it, nor did we, you know, I don't know if we deserve it. And it's worth paying attention to the FX press releases that might not get the attention, right? Like when they announce a big thing like Great Expectations with Olivia Colman, the co-production with BBC, that's huge. But also in this avalanche of content, they're talking about a show called The Bear, which is a half-hour comedy set in a restaurant in Chicago starring Jeremy Allen White, who is on Shameless. But also Hiro Murai is involved. I'm not sure if he's directing it. The sort of internet-famous chef Maddie Matheson is advising. Could be cool. Like, if you think about it, do you want a restaurant show that's top-heavy with celebrity involvement or professional chef involvement, or do you want something that is scrappy and that you're not checking for, that's going to make stars rather than have stars make it? Like, that's a cool spot.
Yeah.
And if they're still working, that makes sense to me.
We could take a break right there. I mean, also, I guess it's worth mentioning that Fargo is coming back for a 5th season. This one's set in 2019. And is it about a kidnapping? Which is notable also because Noah Hawley's also apparently working on this alien show that you know, we haven't heard much about, other than I think he was talking about like it being more about the corporate side of Alien.
Class warfare. I think the Alien one is probably the one to look at, because that is the, not just if you're a fan of it, but like that is such an interesting test case for the FX culture versus the culture that TV actually exists in 2022.
Yeah.
Because it's Noah, who has a long history and relationship with FX. And, you know, I think candidly, the relationship is, Noah, what do you want to do?
Right.
Okay. And then this, not saying that this was forced on him, but I'm sure the corporate overlords at Fox and now Disney are happy when the expensive talent is working on, you know, potentially nutrient rich slabs of IP from the meat locker.
Right. So, even if that is the Weyland-Yutani show and it's about like, you know, offshore, yeah, I mean, off planet mining.
We went down this road before. I wrote on it. Like Legion was them being like, hey, Noah, do you want to play in the X-Men universe? And he's like, sure. And right. That was not necessarily the show for people who liked it when Quicksilver ran fast. So it'll be interesting.
Right. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the new show Severance on Apple.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com. This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, we're back. Andy, I'm fired up. I thought this was a great show. We are talking about the first two episodes of Severance. We're not going to get too into spoiler territory in case people are listening to this beforehand. So this is more of an enthusiastic, ringing endorsement of this show. I wanted to ask you a little bit off the top. Now, I can give you the log line in case you don't know. It stars Adam Scott and Britt Lower. It's about a, I don't know, I wouldn't call it dystopian, but it's like a kind of like somewhat altered reality to our own, where these group of people go into an office every day and at a corporation. And when they go to the office, they are separated from their memories of their outside life. So basically it's about people who are one person at work and another person outside of work, and that there is something that they go through at work that basically makes it so that they're not aware of their at home version of themselves, for better or for worse. And that's a very cool Black Mirror-y setup. And the episodes are directed, most of them I think are directed by Ben Stiller, if not all of them. And they're
about half the season.
Yeah. And it was written or created by a guy named Dan Erickson. And these scripts had been, I think you had mentioned to me, oh, like those were, that was a very hot script for a while, right?
This is, I know our listeners love Industry Andy more than almost any other character that we play.
This is useful info. This
full
is
disclosure,
ceremonial-grade industry news right here.
This isn't usually the case, but I did read the first three scripts for this show last year, and they're dynamite. I mean, they're dynamite. I don't know Dan Erickson. I've never met him, but the scripts were thrilling to read. It is very, very rare to read something on the page that so clearly and boldly articulates a specific vision, but also has a very, very distinct point of view and tone. Mm-hmm. There are Charlie Kaufman-esque elements in it, but they are delivered in a package that is, I actually lack some of the words to describe this.
It's funny you should say Kaufman, because I was going to say my pitch for this show is it's mm-hmm. Michelle Gondry directing a 70s paranoid thriller.
Yeah, I mean, the Eternal Sunshine thing is there on both sides, the visuals and in the story. But there is, I guess the thing that I want to say is that there was an efficiency to it.
Yeah.
You know, it delivered. And part of my enjoyment in seeing the first few episodes of the show, and I've not, like you, I've not watched beyond the first two, is seeing the way that an excellent script was both elevated and in some ways restrained in healthy ways by a kick-ass production. So it is, you know, on the page, there's an enormous amount of, like, there's a lot of whimsy, right? Like, and sort of a little bit askew humor. So the series begins with a woman passed out on a conference table and a voice, we find out later, is Adam Scott's voice coming from a small, intercom
like
box.
Like a speaker, yeah.
Asking her who she is and if she can remember any U.S. states or territories. And the only one that she answers is that she remembers Delaware. There's also, as we learn as the pilot episode unfolds, there's deep grief at the heart of it and sadness. And it's set, you know, perfectly in upstate New York winter to capture that. But you read these things on the page and you get excited about potential. And look, they're just phenomenal writing. Like, I'm not trying to pretend that this was somehow bad and raised up. It was excellent on the page. But you watch this and you're like, oh, you can get, because it's Apple, you can get some of the best actors. You know, you can get Adam Scott to play a part that was almost like written for Adam Scott. You know what I mean? You can have a interesting supporting character with potential and you can get John Turturro to play him. You can bring in Christopher Walken off the bench. You know what I mean? And Apple can do that for you. And these actors are going to elevate and find emotion in things in the scenes that you might not necessarily find it in. Then you get the production design, which is just phenomenal. It's a beautiful show. You get Jessica Lee Gagné, who's Ben Stiller's preferred cinematographer. She shot Escape from Dannemora or Escape at Dannemora. And the light, you know, the snow versus the snowy winter failing light versus the bright fluorescence of the office. Just crisp, kick-ass, amazing. And the music is wonderful. And then Ben Stiller, like, from all accounts, an exacting auteur. But the guy can direct. And you combine all those things with the swagger of both money and talent, and you get a show that doesn't feel like anything else on TV right now. And I think that my enthusiasm for it comes from the fact that I'm super into it. I think it's funny and interesting. But also, it's different right now. It is zagging when TV is zigging. It does not feel like the same machine that produced Pam and Tommy, which I'm sorry has become our go-to punching bag. It's not. It's just that type of show that we're going to get a lot of this year, with whether they're good or bad. We've talked about this. This is an original idea that has some relevance to our current cultural psyche, done with not just high style, but specific style. And that's what I really, really am responding to.
I do think that it's a pretty resonant, there's some pretty resonant ideas in there. They're just not tackled straightforwardly or head on. So, like, this idea that you could hide from your private life in your work, or hide from your work life mm-hmm. in your private life, and that you might choose to do so, that might be something that you were using as a coping mechanism. I won't get into too much of, like, the plot details of the second episode, which starts to reveal a little bit more about Adam Scott's character and the sort of setup of the show itself. But you're right. It's like a totality of vision thing. And it's really not a knock against other TV shows. I don't think that it's necessarily like a comparison. It's just like, you're right. They spent the money. They knew what they wanted. They picked this, like, setting, and extracted as much sort of vibe and atmosphere out of each snowflake as they possibly could. Clearly, Ben Stiller just is like, this upstate New York thing is very interesting to That's me cinematically. Thing, yeah. Like, he did Dan Amore, he's doing this. I think it's really effective. Anybody who's ever spent time up north in the Northeast in winter kind of knows that feeling of like, you basically have to have a change of clothes to deal with the elements. And that, like, I really liked like how Adam Scott has to like take his mud boots off to put his dress shoes on when he gets to work. Like, that was a very familiar thing my dad used to do all the time in Philadelphia in the winter.
Chris, do you feel differently now or more open to the idea of severing your work life from your personal life now that you've told the listeners of your professional podcast where you prefer to have a pillow at night?
Like, you know, it's funny you should say that, though, but like, I think that this show hits a little bit different after working from home for 2 years.
Yes, exactly. That's kind of what I meant about the context, yeah. Right? Like, this is a moment to think about what offices are for and what work culture is and what we're buying into. Totally.
Yeah.
Right?
And also just like the idea of like, yeah, exactly. Like, all this stuff that seems to go along with work that I'm not necessarily wasn't always there, but in terms of buying into the identity of the place that you work beyond and their values beyond just like, here's my services for this fee, you know, like, here's like, let's just have like a kind of cut and dry relationship. I'm not sure that wasn't the way it was for our parents growing up and the jobs that they were working, but it's really cool to watch it depicted in this show. And I also think that, you know, we often comment about this with comedies, specifically sitcoms, where, you know, you want to give them like 4 or 5 episodes to kind of get the training wheels off, mm-hmm. and calibrate all the performances and calibrate the tone and get everything kind of set. And this show's able to have its cake and eat it too. Because of the bifurcated nature of these people's lives, there can be a different show happening on the outside that's happening mm-hmm. on the inside. And even though they influence one another, I thought it was a very effective way of being like, Turturro can be dialed up to 11 and having a blast in there. And Zach Cherry can be awesome. People may remember him from the amazing Succession episode he was on. But you can also have like an overall feeling to the show that feels like everybody knows what they're doing and everybody knows where it's going, which is like a really awesome feeling to have when you're watching a show.
Yeah, it's got all the elements. I mean, it is leaning into, as the season develops, clearly, like, there's a paranoid thriller, there's a conspiracy thriller element to it, and that can exist outside, whereas inside it is sort of a savage, not even satire, just sort of almost, you know, just depressing kind of reflection about what workplace culture even means. Everybody knows you, Chris, are an exceptional basketball podcaster as well. So I you could do a better job with this analogy than I can. But one thing that I wanted to point out was that to have a championship team, this is relevant to us as Philadelphia fans as well, a lot of attention and chatter goes towards star hunting. Like, clearly to win an NBA title, you need at least one of the 10 best players in the league and maybe 2 or 3 of the top 15.
It sounds like you need 2, yeah.
Seems like it. I'm going to go with 2 currently as a Philadelphia 76ers fan. But what you also need, if you somehow manage to accomplish that, is you need to nail the low-cost hires as well. You need to have the role guys and the glue guys, and you need to pick up the right rookie contracts or cheap one-year deals or whatever. You need to get that. You need to make those decisions. Those decisions matter too. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what another one of the sort of maybe small bore, but ultimately really impressive things about Severance to me is that, yes, the cast is top heavy with famous TV stars who I'm sure, you know, did not take a gentleman's or gentle lady's discount to be on this television show, sure. And nor did and Apple can certainly afford it. It's that on the margins, they nailed it time and time again. So you mentioned Zach Cherry, who is a familiar face for anyone who watches the HBO recycling casting program. I mean, he was also on Crashing. He's always a welcome sight. This is the biggest part I've seen him in, and he's perfect for it. He's mm-hmm. a perfect foil. You want that guy in the room to make the conversations a little bit funny or different. You mentioned Britt Lower, who's a great actor who I've been checking for a while and has never really had the breakout lead role, and she's phenomenal, ready for the close-up. And then especially there's a guy named Trammell Tillman, mm-hmm. who plays Milchuk. Yeah. I've never seen this actor before. He's been working in a bunch of shows that I just missed. Looks like he was in Dietland and looks like he was on Godfather of Harlem. He's phenomenal. And again, I read this show. And I pictured someone very different doing something very different in this part. And every scene he's in, he's wonderful and changes up the vibe and energy.
Yeah. Like,
the show doesn't work if you don't get those smaller hires, not smaller in terms of importance, but in terms of what's happening to your budget. And if I could, this budget thing I wanted to circle back to anyway in today's pod, because last week in the middle of trying to just come clean about how I don't understand what Bitcoins are, we went off on a small tangent about like the state of TV, which, you know, again, just classic The Watch. I think we sandwiched it between totally unnecessary conversation. So it wasn't really a headline, but we were talking about like, would Mad Men get made today?
Sure.
And I think the thing that I often forget to include in the conversation is really one about money. So when we say, you know, AMC won't make it because it won't get attention and Netflix won't make it because they just want to buy it when it's finished, what this means is what price point are people going to buy it at? And what is the game of chicken that exists to do that? And basically what it comes down to is you could make Mad Men with no stars today. You know, someone might take a chance on it, but likely they wouldn't, because to compete with the 540 other new shows coming out this year, shouts to John Landgraf, you're going to get lost.
Mm-hmm.
So the smaller networks feel like they can't take that bet. They need to put all of their money into at least one star to make it work. But then the rest of the show kind of either falls apart or, you know, or isn't there. So they're not making those shows because they can't afford to make them. Apple can afford to make them. And then also TV is not one monolithic entity where one person is making decisions. This script is so good, someone was going to make it.
Yeah.
You know, it's exceptional. It was going to get made. And then it found itself in a place where everyone's interests aligned, where you had Ben Stiller and you had big actors and you had Apple. And now it's in the perfect place because Apple may or may not release the viewing data for the show. We don't know. It hasn't even premiered yet. But the show is already one of the most significant shows that Apple has ever made, probably second after Ted Lasso.
Because this show is
currently 97% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, and Apple's never had a critical hit before.
There was a rave about it on, Ted Lasso was something of a critical hit, I think, in its first season especially.
But I think having a critical hit drama...
It's the first time I've seen an Apple show get released and see the raves that this has gotten. And if Andy and I sound a little bit like I'm trying to detect... It's not like we're at all off the show. It's like actually just like the content of the show makes you think about stuff in a way that it's not like a feel good show. Do you know what I mean? Like it's not. And I think that sometimes comes out when you're talking about a show like that, where it's like, if it makes you believe in the power of humanity, like you maybe you're a little bit more effervescent, or if it's really over the top, maybe you yourself are over the top. But I think when I think and talk about Severance, I'm like, yeah, man, it's pretty fucked up out there.
Yeah. Well, actually it's interesting. I didn't find it. I've heard other people say this. I was all in.
Oh, it didn't
in
depress
I found...
me. I was just like, there's just not like moments where you're just like, whoa, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
it's also, look, it's a slow burn, you know? And one thing I'll say, Ben Stiller took the scripts and he made them slower.
Right.
Like he put air into this show. You know what I mean? Like in the pilot, there's a moment where I was almost, the only moment I was ever on the fence is when Adam Scott's character Mark arrives at work and he starts walking through the hallways. And then three full camera minutes later, he's still walking through the hallways. You know what I mean? Like that is a choice. And ultimately I came around because of course it was beautifully shot and it worked for the show and the vibe that he was trying to promote, but also kind of, and this, I know this goes against a lot of my instincts as a TV as a writer's medium, Ben Stiller has the quan to make that choice,
right?
Which makes the show feel different. Longer, slower, rarely better, just as a blanket statement, in my opinion, but it made the show feel different.
Yeah.
There's a version of it where the tone goes the other direction and tips over onto itself because it's too clever or cute and doesn't understand
the heavier
emotions.
If in episode 6, we're still spending 3 minutes getting into the office, like I think maybe that will have like a different kind of effect on you. But when you're watching it the first time or two, you're like, I fully understand how hidden this is. Like these guys have to go down this elevator and down this hallway and down another hallway and down this hallway just to get to work. And so this must be a very secretive, off the books kind of place if that's happening. So that made sense to me, but I agree with you where I'm like, man, like we're really enjoying like this person's commute.
It was very refreshing to encounter it. It is a show of high quality and substance.
Right.
You know, and that is not necessarily a dig at other shows that we've liked less. I mean, part of the quality and substance comes from the money on the screen in all departments. You know, it is evident, but also you're working with people who know what to do with it. And so I feel like we're in good hands, and I'm really happy about the show.
Yeah, we can talk about it more in depth in our next episode if you want to talk about any of the sort of plot details of the first two episodes. But we don't want to give anything away for folks. We can wrap it up there. We were produced, as always, by Kaya McMullen on the ones and twos. Andy Greenwald appears courtesy of Billy Bob Thornton's second hat, but not the first one.
Kaya, am I misremembering? I feel like in one of your production notes, you said, talk more about sleep patterns and how you like to get cozy. Right?
Kaya,
like,
is it that weird that I have a pillow between my knees and I'm not pregnant?
No, that is actually how you're supposed to sleep, because then your spine doesn't get curved as you're sleeping.
Bang.
Helps with your lower back as well.
And my back feels okay. Like, I was having back problems when I started doing this.
My back feels okay now. Is that
Ask about me, man.
Could it feel better, though?
Oh my God, you guys are blowing my mind. Okay, I'm going to go put on a couple hats and fix my spine.
Show a pillow between your legs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We'll probably talk about Severance more the next time we chat. Well, we got some Gemstone stuff coming up to chat about, and lots of really good stuff. As John Landgraf said, the age of bewilderment is upon us. Andy, talk to you soon.
Have a wonderful holiday weekend.